Hi there and welcome to this week's episode of the show. Like I said in the introduction, we want to revisit some of our interviews with various people living with disability. You know, for me, tenacity is such an attractive virtue. If you like, the ability to persevere. I'm told many times of people who they just when they are almost at their goal, about to get what God wants for them, they give up. There's a story I read in a book of a man who was digging for gold in the days of the gold rush in California and the USA, in those days, the cowboy days. And he had bought this land because they had done they've done a kind of a prospectus of the land, and they felt there was minerals there. But they dug and dug for months. Nothing. He dug and dug until he was weary. He had lost so much money from the people he employed, and he gave an ultimatum. If we dig all this week and nothing, he's selling off the land. So they dug all that week and there was nothing. So he sold off the land. Do you know that he sold off this land at next to nothing? And the man who bought it dug just for less than a week and hit gold. And they were like, if only he had dug a little bit more, he would have been there. When I interview people like the guests we're going to see tonight, when I interview people who have lived with disability and served God, I'm always blown away by their tenacity. Their tenacity because of the kind of backlash they get from society, the kind of obstacles they have to go through. Some of them, they look to be like heroes. Often when I sit with people living with disability, one of the questions I like to ask them is, how did you feel when you became conscious of the fact that you were living with a disability? And here's what they have to say.
Of course, I started to feel a bit funny, cloudy eyes. I went to my ophthalmologist. He told me what I was comfortable with. But over time, I knew that something was just not right. But eventually, after going around 1, 2, 3 other places at the night place I went to, not being properly referred, I might also say, I got a final diagnosis. And I will not forget the 10th of August 2007, when I walked out of a certain ophthalmologist expert service that said that not only did I have glaucoma well advanced, it also said that because of the years of the buildup I had, I was at risk of retina detachment in both eyes. So it was for me double whammies. I had never before that day really heard of glaucoma. I'd always used glasses since I was 10, so I was very aware that I was short-sighted. But glaucoma, I didn't know. Retina detachment, what is that? And that started a journey of, I was dazed. Sometimes in my mind's eye, I still see myself in the compound of that eye care organization with complete disbelief. That's why I was holding the paper. And I really felt like everything that I thought life was going to be was flashing before me. But ultimately, like, no, this cannot. So, yeah, it was hard. I would say that the first thing I did was to pray a lot, bind, cast, no, rejecting the doctor's report. I did everything I knew. I also felt like maybe I had not been as diligent a Christian as I was supposed to have been. So I tightened up my Christianity.
So maybe the bad was happening as a consequence of not being good enough.
Yes.
Okay.
So I did my best to keep as pure thoughts as possible and to believe as much as possible and not to pick fights or do. In fact, I tried to be good. It did not last too long because I was also very impatient. I was like, God, aren't you going to do something? God, aren't you real? God, won't you take this away? And then it was now anger.
Okay.
I look back then, I mean, this was now towards the late 2007, and I was angry that how can this still remain? I've been diligent in my service.
It was deteriorating.
Okay, so again, glaucoma, the way it works is because of the pressure on the optic nerve. Okay. It is a deteriorative condition that ultimately ends up in blindness. So essentially it's that the optic nerve has been pinched, and then once it's pinched, the message is not going. So the retina is working well, your eye is working well, hopefully the retina is getting the message. It's trying to pass it through the pipe to the brain, but okay, so the message gets to a point, but it doesn't go through the past the pinch point. That's what's going on with glaucoma. So everything is working, but the message will just not go through. And it was clear it was going to be degenerative. It was also clear that any intervention that was going to happen would only just arrest the situation where it was, and then subsequently with age anyway, you would still lose the sight. But I was like, no. What were the things that I found difficult to do? I began to find it hard to navigate spaces. I started to find it hard to identify people. So I stopped calling people by name. So little things that my colleagues...
Because you don't know who is in front of you.
I can't see your face. Yeah. I can't see your face. So but so I couldn't call people by name anymore. I began to restrict the work, like where I went in the name of work. So by then I'd also grown to become a team lead, and so what I'd done was to put structures in place whereby I drove the team that was in the office to make sure we delivered, and put a layer between myself and the client. So they went to the client premises to do the client engagement. It was also a good strategy to continue to build talent and pull up others. I was building my successors everywhere I went, but it was also a way for me to manage not needing to be out there myself. So I only went in when there were escalations, and but the team was fantastic. You know, we worked very well in a cohesive way. So that way, I mean, they got great things done. I could remain in comfort zone in the in more stable areas for me. By the time I now got the opportunity to work outside the country, I embraced it because I took it as an opportunity I was not going to really get. I was terrified of how will I cope, because I'd kind of like created structures around me.
Yeah, you're becoming a bit more familiar with the new
I had not
new
fully
reality.
Disclosed. Of course, my HR was aware.
Okay.
Of course, my line manager was aware. But with the way I also worked, so I would arrive very early, so you did not need to see me manage to navigate
stairs. Trying to find your way around.
And everybody left, and I would leave late, and then I would find myself a way around. So I did everything for people not to notice, because I was still waiting for this miracle.
Forgot to do the miracle.
It has to happen. He cannot leave me like this. He gave me this opportunity. He's blessed me with so much.
He's going to bring back your sight.
That this was just a test. This is going to go, you know. And while I was waiting, I was reluctant to confess it. Unlike today, where I comfortably use a cane, I never used a cane because I was like, that would be validating that this is going, this is here to
stay. It's
like
you're owning it.
And I was not ready to do so. And the beauty was, when I went to Ghana, I mean, again, I did manage to put systems around, but you know, in Ghana, I felt freer. Because now I was totally with strangers. They accepted who they met. Unlike in my office in Nigeria, you know, my colleagues knew a certain Dolapo. The Dolapo who was very active and who would be part of planning even all the extra things. We'll do CSR stuff, and Dolapo is on top of things. And all of a sudden, and maybe now in hindsight, if they will think about it, now they now had a lot more, a Dolapo that was a lot more quiet, who was wearing darker shade clothes, who was not so willing to do the anything that was outside only work, who was coming in earlier and closing late. So you might just have someone around you who somehow their behavior has sort of like changed. There might be more going on than just what you see. So
I like to think that I had a pretty normal childhood, apart from the fact that I couldn't do the same things that my peers were doing, aka I couldn't walk, I really couldn't use my hands appropriately, and you know, I had what we would call crossed eyes, or you know, in medical terms, strabismus, which was quite obvious. I had a pretty regular childhood. Well, if you discount all of the medical procedures, of course, and all of the stays in and out of the hospital, my parents were busy raising the child they had, and they weren't raising a disability, so I was pretty much having fun.
Well, it was as though my world was shattered. We were devastated, you know, my husband being the man. You know, I think he has always been my bedrock. He was, you know, for him, he took it like a man. he took it well, I think, better than I did. Because when you have when you're pregnant, you have all these dreams of what you expect, being your first child, the school your child will go, what your child will do. And you're telling you that your child can do this, your child can do that. I mean, it makes you weak. It makes you confused. It makes you feel as though you have a death sentence, in quotes, on your head. So before I got the diagnosis, I'd seen a bit of, you know, as a mom, your child was supposed to meet this milestone, the child didn't meet that milestone. But as a Christian, you say, I reject it, not my portion and everything. So when I finally knew this was it, you know, of course, I spoke to my mom and she was like, man, this is the handwork of the devil. We have to go for deliverance. So I will take my daughter, we'll go to church, we'll go for prayers, we'll go for deliverance. And, you know, when I didn't get the result that I wanted, I became more depressed. You know, I became, it was as though God had forsaken me. I mean, I'm a Christian, I pay my tithe, I'm a worker in church. I mean, why would this happen to me? And in Africa, you look around, you don't see such children in church, you don't see them in school, you don't see them in the malls. So how come in the 1 billion plus, it was me? That, so what exactly, so I had questions for God. What exactly have I done that you could not tell me, you could not forgive me, that you had to punish me through this way? So I had so many questions. I was angry, I was bitter, and yes, I had to pray and fast for healing. You know, so it was a myriad of feelings, emotions, confusion, you know, at that moment. And it went on for a while.
So it's not just even what most of these people go through when they realize what they now are living with. It's often how other people react to them. I think it adds to the whole stress of it. And I always would want to find out what was the reaction of society, the church, and those around you when it came to your disability. And this is what they would say.
And then my dad's watching the news one day, and then he suddenly screams, "Somebody give me a pen." On the news, he had seen a private university, you know, advertising admission, and law was on the courses, on the list of courses that the school was going to admit for. So he quickly took a pen, wrote down all the details, and the next day he drove to the address and picked up a form and then brought it home and said, "Sit down there and fill that form." So he then drove me to Edo State to write the entrance exam for the school. I write it, and the way that the school, I don't know if they still do it the same way till today, but back then what they did was, you took the exam, then you literally sat in the hall, and then they came, marked it immediately, and then they came out and just called the names of the people who passed. And then they take you to a different hall, and then they start calling you in for interviews one-on-one. So we just literally sat there, they called my name, they said I passed, and then they moved us to the interview room. And at some point, they called my name to go into the room to do the interview. And I will never forget this, because there were four men. It was this really long table, four men sitting down, and I walked into the room, and I could see their jaws just slack, right? Because they hadn't seen a student with a disability trying to come for admission before. And then they look at me and they're like, "Law?" And I'm like, "Yes." And then they're like, "First of all, this school is not built for people like you." I'm like, "I do not understand what that means." The guy says, "Okay, let me break it down for you. You're not going to be able to last a semester here." I said, "Oh, that's your problem? Watch me last 5 years." At this time, let me put this in context, I was 17. See, my parents had done so much of a great job of building it was so much confidence. People called it pride. Like, I was like, "Watch me last 5 years." The guy looks at me and is like, she's sassy and smart, because based on all our grades, I can't officially deny you admission. So I have to give it to you. But here's what our advice: don't waste your parents' money. Don't bother coming. I said, "Can I have my admission letter?" I take it. I go out and I give it to my dad, and I never tell him this happened. So he never hears about this. And I remember one time, it's 100 level. 100 level is 100 level is the ghetto in any school, right? Because you're borrowing courses from everywhere. They're constantly moving you from here to there. You know, we're moving around, and I'm sitting and I'm, you know, backing the entrance to my class. And the dean of the faculty is walking past, and then she's talking to another lecturer, and she's saying, "Oh, I hear that there's a disabled student in this 100 level class."
And she didn't know you were hearing her.
She knew I was hearing her. And then I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Who was the idiot that did that admission? Like, how is she supposed to survive here in my faculty? Were they dreaming?" And I sat there just nodding, like, "Oh my God, these guys do not know what's about to hit them, because I'm coming for you people." So but the thing was, we resume. And then I realized that my problems are multifaceted, because I come out of my room, right? I'm trying to walk to my hostel entrance where you get a cab to go to class. And the next thing I see, girls are jumping out of their rooms in their towels. I'm not even kidding you. They're lining the streets. And what are they doing? They're staring. I'm passing commentary. Like, just passing commentary. How did this one grow up to be this old? How is she not dead? What's she doing here?
Wow.
And I'm like, well, I'm just keeping it moving. Like, I think that I've just always had this ability to just not listen. So I just kept walking, and I walked. And that was my reality for the entire first week. Every time I stepped out of my room, I was the attraction of the whole hostel. Until I think they then appointed a spokesperson. So I think the beginning of the second week, this spokesperson just literally waits for me to come back from class. So basically they now know my routine, right? So she's waiting for me to come back from class, and on my way back, she goes, "Excuse me." And then I'm like, "Me?" She's like, "Yes." I'm like, so I cross and I walk over to her. She's like, "What's your name?" I tell her. She's like, "Oh, you're Yoruba." I'm like, "Yeah." So she's like, "Do you speak the language?" I'm like, "Yes, I do." She's like, "So good. So we can switch this conversation, because this conversation will be better in Yoruba." I was like, "Go on." And then she asks, basically in Yoruba, like, "What are you doing here?" I said to her, "The same thing you're doing here, getting an education." She says, "Where do you live?" As in, at home. I'm like, "I live in Lagos." She says, "Okay, so that means your parents, they must be very wicked people, because if they brought you all the way from Lagos here, they don't like you." I was like, "Oh, that's as far as you know. And I mean, I can't help your ignorance, but it's okay." She's like, "You're really, really sassy." I was like, I've needed to be to survive if I'm going to deal with people like you. She's like, "Okay, I'm smart." I was like, "I mean, I didn't buy my admission into this school, if you get what I mean." And from that point on, I think she went to go and tell the rest of the crew. And so they stopped staring and heckling me. And so it started to be a thing that was now left with the faculty. So the faculty was waiting for me to fail. So I finished the first year, and then we resumed for the second year. And one of the guys that was on my interview panel, he's the lecturer, he's teaching law of contracts in 200 level. So he comes into class, and I'm sitting on the first row, first seat on the third row. And then he sees me, and he's like, "You're still here?" Like, he couldn't, I don't think he did it on purpose. He just didn't catch himself. He came out of him honestly without thinking, "You're still here?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, absolutely." So he calls another lecturer, and he says, "Come, give me your matric number." So I give it to him, and he goes, "Go and get me the result for that matric number for 100 level." So that one comes, and I give it to him. She's like, "She's passing. You're actually passing." I'm like, "Oh, you were waiting for me to fail? Not gonna happen." So my friends at that point are like, "What's going on?" I'm like, "Oh, it's water under the bridge, guys. We got this. Let's go." And pretty much, I mean, I made it through 5 years of uni in record time, by the way. So.
A friend of mine went to her pastor and said, "Oh, we should train the junior church teachers to be able to work with children with disability." And the pastor said, "Oh, we don't have such children here." And the person laughed, because people keep their children at home, because the church is not accepting.
There's no space for those kinds of
children. It's not space. It's not just space.
We don't create it.
It's not welcoming for people with disabilities. It's not welcoming. So when you go on the pulpit and the worship leader is trying to energize people and say, "Oh, if you have eyes, if you have legs, you know, jump up and praise the Lord." What about the man
who has no
in
eyes,
the congregation who has no eyes?
No,
he has a much bigger faith. For him to come and worship God without eyes and legs, how do you want him to feel? You know, the junior church teachers are not trained on how to work with children with special needs. If you bring a child with disability and sit down in a row, maybe two people will not even sit down beside you. The church needs to understand that these children are not demonic.
Yeah.
So if we begin to change the narrative, you know, say it on the pulpit, these children are not demonic. God made us all. We are children of God. And we should show love,
beautiful
kindness to one another. This is the kind of love Jesus was talking about, you know?
And it should start in the church.
Exactly, exactly.
So the church, right? Like I said, especially the church generally, but the church in Africa, right? We have a problem with anything that is not perfect. because we see every good and perfect gift is from above and from the Lord, from whom there's no shadow of turning. So when we say that, and then once it doesn't look perfect by human standards, it cannot be from the Lord. And so because of that, we treat people with disabilities as defective, especially in church. So when you come into the church, the first thing they're thinking is this person needs deliverance, prayer for healing, binding and casting the demons that are afflicting them, and all of those things. And so it goes back into how we even, so let's talk about how we even build our churches. It's coming in this morning. And I was like, here you go. The average Nigerian church does not think that a person with a disability is supposed to come into their service as a service provider. So I remember that when I was a unit leader in my church, for over a decade, when we go to annual meetings, right, I would look around and I'll be the only person with a disability that was a leader that was in those annual meetings. And I'm talking thousands of people. And I would wonder, like, this church is so big. It's a worldwide church. How is it that there are no people with disabilities that are leaders, that are obviously leaders in this church? Where are they? But the church has socialized it in such a way that if you have a disability, you need healing. So once you enter the church, there's just the assumption that you came so that you could be prayed for to be healed. So when I was growing up in church, like I said, my parents, you know, church people, throughout my childhood, it was my parents' fault that I wasn't healed. So my mom got the brunt of it. She was told she wasn't praying enough, she wasn't fasting enough, so she would drag me to every deliverance service, every revival, every anything, crusade, she would. And then I turned, I think, 12, and then I said to her, Mommy, I'm done. I'm not going to any deliverance service, crusade, whatever, anything again. If Jesus wants to heal me, he does not need a crusade to do it. The minute I became a teenager, it became my fault. So every time we went to a church meeting, it was my fault that I wasn't healed. I was the one who didn't have the faith. I was the one who wasn't praying enough. I wasn't fasting enough. I wasn't giving enough. I wasn't whatever you could come up with as a reason for me not being healed. And I remember that I would be like, has it ever occurred to anybody that the fact that I showed up this way on this earth, like, it was not a mistake? Like, has it ever hit you that Jesus was not asleep? Because he says to me that I am his workmanship, that he created for good works, that he had designed before time that I would do. So when he was fashioning me based on the good works that he had designed me to do. He needed me to be this way, because if I wasn't this way, how would I have been helping, I mean, almost 600 children with disabilities on Mississippi that are currently on my client list? But, you know, at that time, nobody could see that. So it was about how you needed to get healed. And this has continued to date, right? I was able to, my usual fashion, just brush it off. I mean, there were times that it got really annoying because I remember a time, even as a leader in church, I got called into a meeting by what people like to call the faith watchers. They basically said to me that you need to go and increase your faith too. I'm not even joking. I was a leader in church at this point. I'd been a church leader for about 7 to 8 years at this point. So in my head, I'm thinking, how have I become the head of believers class? So I'm basically teaching foundation school. I'm teaching new believers. I'm teaching your adult Sunday school. In short, I'm leading the team of teachers that's teaching your adult Sunday school, but I don't have faith. Are you serious? Are you kidding me right now? So it was that, I think for me, that was one of the bigger ones that really threw me. But it was in everything. So for instance, my church is rebuilding, which kind of happens with churches. Like, we're always expanding. We're trying to build more churches. We're trying to build a bigger auditorium. And we're trying to build a bigger auditorium. And so it's then going to have like an elevation and all this fancy stuff. So I go to the head of the building committee and I say, please make sure that there's a ramp entrance, because if we're going to do this elevation thing, you know, we need to be able to get into church. And then he goes, instead of you to come praying to get healed, now you're asking for him.
Instead of all the people on wheelchair to be healed, why should we ask? So we have faith for building without ramps, because everybody's going to be healed.
And then I insist. I'm like, you can put the ramp there. And then he goes, so they build the ramp. And then you know what he says to me on the Sunday that he wants to test the ramp? He goes, Sister Toby. I'm like, yes. Oh, your ramp is there.
It's for you, not your ramp. That don't have faith.
Go and test it. And I'm like, excuse you? Like, did you just call it my ramp? You to go and test it. You have legs. And the thing that's funny now, they called it my ramp, but today it's the most used entrance in that church. Everybody uses it.
Then, of course, this is important to me, how they overcome. And this is where I start to draw lessons for myself. Is how did you overcome the pain as well as the stigma related to living with this disability?
One day, you know, my friend called me that there was this pastor. I stay on the island. There was this pastor on the mainland. I should go to his church for prayers. And that day, I went to his church, you know, with my daughter and her caregiver. And on our way back, I almost had a terrible accident. I almost entered into a ditch. So when I got to my house, I sat down and said, "Pookie, what exactly are you looking for?" You know? And I decided, you know, to hand over everything to God and to just rest. So it was at that moment I started finding my peace. You know, I just calmed down. No more hustling here and there. Where's the next cure? Let's do this. I said I wasn't doing anything again. And at that moment, I began to have my peace.
So for me, after a short stint in the hospital to have immediate intervention to at least arrest the situation to the best of what was available around me, I did go back to the office and I had a conversation with my line manager expecting to be dismissed from work.
Given that now you need your sight for your work.
Yes.
They should now ask you to go away. So what did she say?
So he actually asked me if I was not interested in my work because for him, he did not see obstacles. He's a European French, and you know, maybe in their own environment, disability like a visual degeneration
was not
an obstacle. So he kept it simple. Are you not interested in your work because we don't have a replacement for you? And that gave me hope. I remember going to the restroom in the office after that conversation. I'm not sure I chose the cleanest one, and I sat on the floor and I cried. I wept, and I came out of that.
And what were you crying about? What was the emotion you were feeling there?
I was just grateful, I think. That was the biggest emotion. The biggest emotion was gratitude that I could still
keep
have this job, this career that...
you love.
That, yeah, grown to love. And now that I was even going to be lost, I loved it more. I wanted to hold on to everything that I could. So the fact that, yes, I still had an opportunity, which I was not expecting, I wept out of gratitude. I there was still some anger. But anyway, I came out of the restroom that day determined to be my very best self, no matter what it was going to take. And from that day, the organization got a very hyper-focused staff in me.
I think it comes from my family.
What did they do right? What did your parents do right?
First of all, I will repeat this. My parents were raising a child. They were not raising a disability.
So they were not looking at you as a child with disability.
Absolutely.
They were just saying,
this is a human being
like
that God gave us. We're going to raise this child the same way we're raising the remaining three. We're not going to be in denial that this child is different. Now, this is where my parents, I think, balanced each other out. My mom was in the medical field, so it was easy for her to get very fixated on all the physical difficulties. My child is not walking, my child can't use her hands, or her eyes look funny. It's very easy for her to get fixated on that. But the thing with that is that it also puts her in that place where she's able to start thinking, what can we do to improve this? My dad, on the other hand, was this person who was just a technical guy. He studied urban and regional planning. So he's a technical, I want to do something. What can we do with what we have? That's the way he thinks. So he's there thinking, okay, fine. This child can't do all these things. Well, what can she do? And the one thing that was clear very early on was that I could speak. I've always been able to speak very clearly. I've always had a very strong voice, very loud. My dad said my voice was so loud. That was like my defense mechanism as a child. So anybody tries to cheat me, I'm just going to scream. Like, they were just going to know something's going on. So my dad said, look, if this child has a voice that she can use, and it tells us that, and she can speak, so we know that she's cognitively competent, I'm just going to focus on the strengths that she has. And I'm not going to stop you, that's my mom now, from trying to improve the weaknesses, but we're not going to stop one for the other. So we're going to do both at the same time. My child is going to be getting an education while, you know, you're doing all this, your medical rigmarole, you want to do therapy, you want to try this surgery, you want to whatever. Go ahead, bring me the bill, but my child is going to be getting an education. And my mom, right, all my siblings are high achievers. When people say I'm a high achiever, I laugh. I'm like, you don't know my family. You need to meet my siblings. Then you realize that, man, I'm the runt of this family ladder. I did not try. So it's kind of a family legacy of just raising rock stars. So when people try to, I'm like, you guys don't get. As far as my family is concerned, I'm not all that. Like, my siblings are like, what are they hyping? It's not like she's that smart. She didn't even, like, finish with the first class. What was all this hype about? Because for them, Yes, you don't really know that much. Because in our family, we were raised to do amazing work. My parents would tell you, you either come home with an A or you don't come home at all. Like, it's A's or nothing, my friend. Let's be guided. I was probably the only one who would come home with B's, and my dad would somehow just let it slide, because it's like, okay, we understand that you have a little bit of a difficulty with writing and stuff.
Now, we come to the last question I always want to glean from these people. It's the lessons learned. And once again, I want you to listen to these lessons they've learned, not just as related to people living with disability, but the fact that you and I, as long as we're facing the giants of life, we're handicapped too. We're like David standing before Goliath. And in that sense, we're dwarfed. And the same lessons they learned here are so crucial for us. And this is some of the important lessons they drew out of this journey.
But my mom, if I came home with a B, she'd remind me, and she'd say it in Yoruba, but I would try to translate. And she would basically say to me, listen, come here, come here. And then once you move close to her, she pulls your ear and she's, listen to me. It is your legs that are impaired, not your brain. So therefore, hear me. You had better use that brain to compensate for the things that your legs cannot do. And let me, look, if you behave like somebody that has cognitive issues, I will beat those cognitive issues out of you. You hear me? And I'll be like, yes, mommy. She's like, good. Now go to that school and go and show them what you can do. Yes, mommy. And of course, you do not try a Nigerian mother. Look, if a Nigerian mother gives you a warning, you better take it, because she's not playing. And when you hear that, and I heard it all the time, my mom constantly said it to me. Every time that I came across something that was difficult in school and I came home and I said, mommy, I can't do this. She's like, listen to me. Your legs are impaired, your brain is not. Figure it out. Your legs are impaired, your brain is not. Figure it out. And because I was constantly told to figure it out, it became the mantra which I live my life. I constantly figure it out, up till today. I constantly say to myself, okay, so my muscles are impaired, my brain is not. I can figure it out. And so I still figure it out. And that's why when people say that it's high achieving, I say it's just figuring it out every step of the way. And that's how I've gotten here.
So I've come to realize that oftentimes, especially as a believer, you don't just go through things for yourself. You go through things so that you can also help those that are coming behind. So for me, it has gone beyond me. It has gone beyond my child. You know, so I'm now using my experience to be a voice for families who have children with disability. I'm being a voice for children who have disability, that they are human beings, first of all, that Jesus died for them too. You know, so, I mean,
and that they should not be hidden away.
Exactly.
You know, when you said that we don't see them.
We
don't see them in church, we don't see them in school.
We don't.
It's not that they are not there, but many times they are locked up somewhere.
Yeah, and I can't blame the parents because the society has some faults as well. I mean, the children will come out and, you know, the families are
labeled.
Oh, you know, they call the father or the mother derogatory names. So nobody wants to be ostracized. Nobody wants to be stigmatized. So because of that, they put up a front for the community to see, and they lock up the child in the house. Okay, so of course, when you get married, you know, usually they said the man is from Moon or Zimmas. And
the other one is from Venus. Jupiter.
You know, so of course, when we got married, we had a communication issue. We're like, I was like, is this what the whole marriage is all about? You know, but along the line, when my daughter came, we both had to calm down because we knew individually we couldn't handle it alone. But together, working as a team, we could face the challenge. So we were humbled by the experience. We're listening more to each other. We're communicating better. And I think through that, we're able to find ourselves first as individuals, then as a couple, then, and it worked for my marriage. Unfortunately, for a lot of mothers that I have seen, having a child with special needs has broken a lot of homes.
Because of the insight my line manager had, the support and the opportunity of being in a space that rewarded performance, they didn't need me to see, They just needed Dolapo to perform.
Wow.
It was that simple. And whether Dolapo could see while she was performing was not top of mind for the organization, because I also did not make it top of mind. And just to share with the audience that I went on to have 11 more years in my career in that organization. And by the time I was moving on out of it to go fully into doing diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting, I mean, my last role, I was a competence center leader for with oversight functions for engineers, boots on ground for 15 countries in Africa. So, you know, again, as long as you can give value, you will always get value. So guys, what I would say is, number one, to realize that nothing happens to you that God was not aware of. So that for me in itself was a pain, but again, it was a comfort. Number two, opportunities kept on opening up for me. They were the kind of opportunities that I knew that this was not about me. This could only be God. Number three, the kind of support I enjoyed from my family and from strangers, you know, willing hands, empathy, then so many opportunities I was not aware of that tie directly to who I am today kept on opening up. And there are not too many people in that space. So I get to get to be this superstar with almost little effort. And there's so much more to do. Number four, I've learned to be grateful. I've just learned to be grateful. And I found that in gratitude, I've attracted so much more than I could ever imagine or contrive by myself. But all in all, I am here for a reason. The good Lord, as long as I have breath, it means that there's still an assignment for me. I think I have found my assignment, which is to shine light into this diversity, equity, and inclusion space. With the technology age that we're in right now, with the fourth revolution that is ongoing, people can work from anywhere. You can give value right here in Nigeria and get paid in hard currency if that's what you aspire to do. You just need to learn the skills to give value, to get value. The opportunities are legion. The best time, honestly, to be living with any sort of disability is right now at this time and day and age. There's so much that can be done. So if we focus on what is possible vis-a-vis mourning over what is gone, you would find that organically you will be able to really come to the place where you'll be able to say, Lord, I thank you. And it will be true. And it will come from the heart with a lot of thanksgiving. And everybody around you will really see that you're not putting out an act, but rather the, you know, that peace that they say that passes all understanding, that you truly have it, and you would end up inspiring others. I would not say it's easy, but I do assure you that once you get to that point where you put yourself 100% into God's hands, you commit it as you go to bed, it's you're in his hands. As you wake up, you recommit your day and whatever opportunities he's going to bring to you, you will find that you will live it and you will celebrate it, and others will come to Christ through you.
Yeah, I hope you've been challenged and encouraged by this, because I feel that there's so much we can learn from people living with disability. And that's why we are revisiting this. I want to encourage you, just like David stood before Goliath, and he was able to know that even though Goliath was physically bigger than him, his God was bigger than Goliath. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. We can learn from the perseverance of this dear brethren, the fact that they could look at disability in the face and be able to persevere to become all that God wants them to be. You too can do the same. Thank you so much for joining us this week in this special edition where we are relooking at some of the interviews we had before. We'll see you same time, same station. Bye for now.